The name of our podcast, TechSequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. My name is Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
And today's topic is security and infrastructure. Leslie, why did we think this was a great idea?
I never have any idea why we think anything is a great idea. Well, because infrastructure is key. Secure infrastructure is key to having security in the internet. If you don't have a secure infrastructure, you've got nothing to build on.
And actually, that's also part of our DNA, if you will, right? That we both started in infrastructure in one shape or form and met in the DNS world, domain name system world, which really underpins everything on the internet. So it's an apt discussion topic to have and talk about what are the consequences of decisions made in technologies and infrastructure on security, on other things. And today's guest is someone both Leslie and I have known for quite a while, will not admit how long, but it's been quite a while. Her name is Suzanne Wolf. Suzanne has led an impressive career in the development and operation of the domain name system, DNS, including the operation of the DNS root servers and the implementation and standardization of the DNS protocols themselves. She served on the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers Board, ICANN, as well as Internet Architecture Board of the Internet Engineering Task Force, known as IETF, where she's currently co-chair of the DNS Operations Working Group, also known as DNSOOP. She is a Senior Director of Technical Community Engagement at Public Interest Registry. Suzanne, welcome.
Thanks, Alexa, and thanks, Leslie.
Indeed, welcome. So just to get started, I wanted to ask you, what got you hooked on the internet technology in the first place?
I love that question. I think it goes back to being a kid that was sort of raised on science fiction, where, you know, the ubiquitous networking and computers everywhere was part of the future. Nobody quite knew how. There were lots of different versions of how that could work out. And I got real interested in how does that actually happen? How do the cool things about that actually, how can we make those things happen? And of course, there were also the dystopias. There were the scary things. And looking back on it, I think that basically all of the good things, you know, all of the things we feared have in some ways come true, but so have all of the things we look forward to. So we get to live with all of it.
We've all got our Dick Tracy watches.
We do. And we have all kinds of things that were science fiction. You know, I checked into a hotel a couple of months ago and it wanted to scan my face and asked me if the profile picture I use on Facebook was me.
Wow. And
that was how I got checked into my hotel.
That's science fiction.
Yeah, exactly. In a foreign country I hadn't been to lately. But also, I've been an infrastructure person, again, since I was a kid, because I was the one that wanted to look behind the curtain. You know, when I was a kid and worked on theatrical productions, you know, I was much more interested in the lighting and the sound than in being on stage.
You were interested in what's behind the green curtain, the Wizard of Oz, were you?
I was interested in how do we enable the stuff that you see.
Right.
And of course, that's something...
Sorry, go ahead. Yep.
No.
Right. What was your first job?
My first real job was I worked for the University of Southern California as a network administrator and a system administrator, right down in the bits of making internet happen for people, you know, for research, you know, for computer science researchers, for people that used it every day and were part of trying to invent more of it.
See, that's the bit that got me hooked on the internet, was that there was that whole era when it was the people who were making it work at home would get together and say, you know, what are the next things we need to develop? How do we need to solve the current problems at early IETF meetings? And then they'd go home and implement them.
This is actually one of the fun things about my involvement with the IETF these days, is in many ways we have gotten away from that. but people are also deeply committed to coming back to it. So particularly with DNS, which is very much production technology,
right?
You know, we joke that we're constantly rebuilding the airplane in flight. And a lot of that does require that same back and forth between building the technology, testing it, explaining it so that somebody else can also implement in the future, lather, rinse, repeat.
Suzanne, talk about IETF a little bit and how some of these standards that we use for DNS and other things come about. It's an interesting organization, and the way that it comes to consensus is also somewhat interesting.
Consensus is an important part of how the IETF works because it's based on the fundamental nature of the internet. As everybody has their own network, everybody has their own priorities, everybody has their own things they're trying to accomplish, but you don't have the internet unless all of those pieces can talk to each other. Not because you have to, not because somebody requires it, but because mm-hmm. that's the way you do what you have to do and you help others do what they have to do. And in order to make that work, everybody has to agree on how you're going to, everybody has to agree on the underlying language. Everybody has to agree what a DNS, you know, with DNS, what the server does when the user asks a question, when somebody's trying to get to a particular resource, that's a query to a server. The server has to recognize the query, has to reply to it. And it turns out that that's very simple in concept, but there's lots of complications to, people want it to do different kinds of data. Now mm-hmm. people want it to recover from different kinds of changes in the environment. Okay, we have to agree on how all of that's going to work.
And it's also interesting too, because even if you don't have new kinds of data that you're storing in it, you learn over time that, you know, it's the be conservative in what you send and liberal in what you accept model, right? I mean, you have to be able to answer queries from anywhere in a public DNS server. And it turns out that there may be different interpretations of how often queries might be made, how quickly they might be made, and that sort of thing.
And people keep thinking of new ways to use DNS and other infrastructure technology, and you don't want to have to negotiate in advance. You don't want to have to call somebody up and say, can we deploy this capability now? You want the software to be able to do the things you need it to do without a whole lot of discussion about the infrastructure. You don't want the infrastructure to be an obstacle. Right. And the other thing, of course, is that because the internet is extremely large now and has lots of people and lots of software and lots of devices that all do things slightly differently, a colleague of ours who's done a lot of research about the way DNS works in the wild, if you will, Jeff Houston at APNIC, likes to say that anything you can imagine people doing in the DNS, they are doing right now.
Yeah.
It's the same with other infrastructure technology, where it has to work even when it's only mostly right.
Well, I guess when DNS was first, envisaged, I mean, it was really designed to be scalable, right? So that it could grow and grow. Obviously, it's grown beyond certainly what I envisioned early on. Right. But it had some other consequences, this growth. I mean, I guess one of the consequences was that, you know, scale is one thing, but you're sacrificing potential security on the other end. What were some other consequences of the way that this was structured that you had to deal with or you saw that was unintended, perhaps?
There's a whole bunch of things that we didn't anticipate because DNS allows people, the sort of assumption about what DNS is for is that it names, it lets you name a resource in a way that's memorable to humans instead of just having a number that a computer will talk to. And at that level, it's just a mnemonic device for humans. You know, it just helps people navigate the internet. But it turns out that ability to name things without necessarily seeing what's behind the name means that you can do all kinds of things that you didn't necessarily anticipate. So DNS names, you know, originally were about a particular computer somewhere. Now they're about pretty much any kind of resource you can imagine. The problem with that, of course, is that the people don't know what they're doing, don't know what they're connecting to, don't know what the name means. And so all kinds of wonderful things can be deployed using DNS names, but also all kinds of things you're not sure you want to know about.
So, yeah, one of the things that's been true about the DNS for a long time is that it winds up, so first of all, it is the largest piece of, I will argue, application infrastructure that is deployed in a distributed fashion. And as such, because we haven't succeeded in deploying any other bits of application infrastructure at that level, we wind up putting everything in it, as you say. It's like, you know, we could deploy a new telephone number lookup system, or we could put it in the DNS. I give you enum.
Right.
I have my own past sins that we don't need to discuss just at this moment in terms of things getting stuck in the DNS. So I guess one question is, say 20 years ago, what did it mean to be aware of security in the DNS, and has that changed?
Oh my, yeah. If you go back that far, I think the security, when people talk about security, they're thinking about a number of things. They're thinking about, do you get the information you asked for? Do you get information you didn't ask for? What happened? Is the service reliable? You know, in fact, in another part of the ecosystem I work in, I'm part of the ICANN Security and Stability Advisory Committee, which actually tends to think of those terms as very closely related. The stability of a service or a resource is closely related to what most people think of as security. And you go back far enough, and the only issues were, as Alexa said, the basic issue was scalability. Could we keep throwing things into this set of machines and protocols and have it continue to work? Now people don't worry about that as much. There are technical methods, you know, people have built the infrastructure, so it's actually extremely hard to compromise in a lot of ways. It's much better in that way than it used to be, even though it's had to scale, you know,
right,
way beyond what anybody intended. But what's more of a problem now, I think, is that DNS is enabling a lot of things to exchange information in ways you can't see. It makes it a lot easier to do a lot of things you don't want, as far as causing people to, you know, people don't see where their information is going.
Right.
People don't see what the devices in their homes, you know, what resources those devices are connecting to, what might be going on behind their backs.
What they're transmitting, what kind of information they're transmitting.
What they're transmitting and what's being transmitted to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, you know, this is something particularly with, you know, Internet of Things, and with some of the platforms that are deploying, you know, some of these resources into people's homes and businesses and so on. The fact that it's all held together in large part by DNS as a way of naming the resources that interact, a lot of that is invisible. A lot of that people don't see, and it's made it extremely easy to conceal not only what the bad guys are doing if you click on that link that's, you know, malware that will come take over your computer, but also where the information is going that, for instance, has my hotel in Singapore asking me if that's really my picture that it got off of, you know, social media.
I think there's a argument to be made that perhaps, you know, the DNS is entirely distributed. No one entity has control of it, of the DNS per se, yet. Although, you know, some countries have tried, right? They've tried to change routing tables or shut down. But what if one argument is, you know, well, what is so bad about potentially having a few organizations really run, let's say, the recursive DNS, and I'll let you just quickly explain what recursive is, that maybe they can actually implement some policies that could, you know, identify the bad, the malware, the threats, and is there any downside to that?
yeah, I can go into that. And for just a minute, first of all, it's a good question about how the pieces of the DNS fit together. The way it typically works is, you know, you're setting up your connection to a conferencing system like we're using now, or you're setting up to a website. The lookup of a domain name doesn't go to the server that knows what kind of computer you want to connect to under that domain name. It goes to a server, to a, what's called a recursive resolver, that is usually operated by your ISP as part of the service you get for having the internet in your home or office. But it could also be run by your enterprise or by a third party service. There are a bunch of web hosting companies, or a bunch of other companies that do, some of them with a value add of, oh, I'm going to make sure that you don't use domain names and DNS lookups to get to resource, you know, to get to
right.
dangerous things, but also some just to provide the service. So you're independent of your ISP.
Google, for example, provides that, right?
Yeah. The problem with that, there's two issues, right? One is that you may be very distant from not only the servers used to provide your DNS resolution, but also the control of it, whoever's administrating it, whatever jurisdiction they're under legally. All of those sort of operational kinds of things, where it's not next door, and it's not necessarily someone you have a business relationship with. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not necessarily someone you have a contract with. So you have less control over what they do with the data they collect by having you sending them DNS queries. And if they're a large provider who gets lots and lots of people sending DNS queries through them, they get a lot of information about who you are and what you care about and what you're looking at and what you're doing on the internet.
But
you don't necessarily have any control over that.
I mean, the ISPs under this administration, I think they now have relaxed rules about what they can do with the data that they collect from you. So ISPs already collect lots of data because they run your recursive resolvers. So what is the difference between them collecting and potentially monetizing it versus, you know, say a company like Google?
So let's actually back up a bit.
Yeah.
And I actually want to answer that question a little bit. Here's an example that's going to make you cringe, Alexa.
Mm-hmm.
Site finder. Say it with me. Site finder. Did I say spike finder? I thought so. So,
gosh, Alexa, I think that's kind of like an inside joke.
Well, you and I were both at TerraSign at the time when they temporarily launched Site Finder, which mm-hmm. was intended to be a support for any of the domains that VeriSign ran at the time. That included .com and .net. If you did a lookup in for a .com name for a name that turned out not to exist, it would say, "Oh, did you mean?" and would give you a different answer.
Helpfully
offer you some alternatives, right? So the idea being how to be helpful in the context when a site somebody was looking for didn't work, it didn't exist. So hullabaloo, just all kinds of madness. No, this is impossible. It's breaking the standard, which frankly it was, possibly breaking all kinds of software, because software like email clients that expected to get a, you know, either get connected or be told the domain didn't exist were being fused, so on and so forth.
So they were not getting the answers that they were expecting.
Right. And so that service was live for, I don't know, days.
For us, it seemed like a long time.
Yeah.
Well, it seemed like a long time. Yes, I remember.
And and the IAB wrote a really nasty, well, it wasn't nasty. It turned out to be one of the better reviews of that whole thing at the time. And that was kind of ugly because I was chair of the IAB at the time. And so that was really one of the few times that I got to talk to the president and CEO of VeriSign, who called me up and basically said, "Why are we paying you to be on the IAB if they're going to write this stuff?" But anyway, it was not comfy times. But now back to your point about what's the difference about, you know, your ISP doing it. Now, most of the ISPs in this country, at any rate, I don't know about other countries, But in the US, it's quite common for an ISP to do just exactly that. Yeah. Now, part of the difference is they can do it because you are their customer, and this is the service that they are offering you. Whereas mm-hmm. with VeriSign operating CommonNet, the people making queries of them are not necessarily their customers. Their only customers were people who had registered names in .com and .net, for instance, right? So there's an important difference there in terms of what is your actual customer relationship between you and the whatever company is providing value add in their service.
Yeah, which was kind of what I was getting at, and thank you because that was very clear. That was really good. But I also there's a funny aspect of it here that I'm actually pretty cautiously optimistic about, which has to do with there's been a recent set of technological innovations around how DNS is done that mean that, you know, long story short, technical glossing over the technical details changes the way DNS resolution is done for certain web-based applications. You know, DNS over HTTPS.
Say it. Right.
Which, you know, the nerds, particularly on Twitter, abbreviate as DOH. This changes the dynamic a little bit because it changes the resolution process for, you know, for certain things. And you know, without going too much into the technical details, it actually highlights the question that Alexa was just asking about who gets to see your DNS queries and what is their relationship with you? What is their interest in not only serving you, but protecting your privacy and your other interests as a user of the internet? And I think the interesting thing about that is that not only are we looking closely at this question of who sees your queries and what's the privacy and security implications of that, but we're also, there's beginning to be discussion of, all right, isn't really the problem people taking that information and using it in ways you didn't authorize and don't know about and might harm you? Isn't that really the problem? And can right. we use both technology and sort of administrative and governance mechanisms to address that, whether you're talking about ISPs or third-party services of the various kinds?
Right.
So what we've actually got in that particular area is a technological change that's driving further technology changes and some governance and administrative.
I think it's sort of, you know, whenever you concentrate power in the hands of a very few, I have not known it to yield beneficial consequences. And, you know, when you concentrate traffic and staying away from all the technical discussions that, you know, have merit, for example, with respect to security and other things. But whenever you concentrate traffic in the hands of a very few, even though they protest today that they will, you know, be very mindful of protecting your privacy and security and whatnot, it's extremely tempting. You know, what did Churchill say? Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? Yep. It's too much of an incentive to later on down the line, perhaps change one little component here, and at that point, you know, the genie's out of the bag, right? I mean, it's not much that you can do.
One of the things that really troubles me in this space, and it's related to the question of too much power concentrated, is it's a pretty small step, and this is what SiteFinder did too in its own way. It's a pretty small step from, you know, here, let me take care of all that for you, to here, let me help you out. This is a better answer, right? I mean, that's what SiteFinder tried to do in its own way. But particularly with the way the DNS over HTTPS stuff is shaping up, it's not a big step in my mind to go from the first order of DNS over HTTPS is going to be, I'll look it up in the DNS, and then it's like, if the DNS doesn't provide a good enough answer, why don't I just look it up in my massive index of the entire web that I happen to have over here, and I'll come up with a different answer for you that isn't based on the DNS, right?
Mm-hmm. So, or the answer I think you should be getting.
Right. And so I think that the problem I have with that is now you're not doing the standard anymore, because you're not giving, you're not, back to Suzanne's earlier point about what is the standard, it's the agreement of when I ask you this, this is what you give me back, and I interpret the results that you give me back in this set way. And so it's not doing the standard anymore, and it makes it very hard to update the standard based on consensus back to the
right. top of our conversation. I guess that's how we've gotten to this place, which is this sort of implicit understanding that we have, we collaborate together to come up with a set of with a standard. Then we implement the standard as the way that we envisioned, right? We don't make any necessary changes. If there are any changes, we bring it back into the same process. And we've been able to come up with today's scenario where we have the internet that we have. But here's another question, which is going to the heart of DNS. Now, there has always been, and as far as I remember, threats against the DNS. If you remember the alternative route, right? Or countries, Russia, for example, China, etc., basically trying to and threatening to say that they're going to break off and then, you know, run their own. Are any of these threats valid? And don't just look at the past one, but is there any potential threat to the DNS that could be, you know, the disruptor, the disruptive technology that's going to come and swipe the DNS and insert something else?
I guess in a lot of ways that's always a fun question, and in a lot of ways it's actually very difficult, because it sort of makes an assumption that if something else comes along, that it'll be ultimately detrimental, that the DNS is the best we can do for putting names on things in the internet, and that it will be swept away and replaced by something else. And I don't actually think that's how technology works. Even with all of the challenges we've created for ourselves and all of the difficulties we have with the internet we have now, there's a couple of things that I think we've learned a lot about in the last 20 years. And one is that you don't generally end up wholesale replacing a technology that has been really useful, particularly not with something that's going to be worse. And I think the DNS and the...
I didn't realize we were talking about IPv6. Sorry.
I'm trying to be, you know, I'm trying to be optimistic here. I think what we'll continue to see is that the ability to name things, computers, resources, activities, objects in the internet is so useful. And DNS provides facilities for that. And the other thing DNS provides is a universal frame of reference where you can have local names if you want and be compatible with DNS, but people find global names, you know, names that mean the same thing pretty much regardless of where you start, so useful that I think they're going to want to preserve that property. So I think what you're going to end up with is a situation where we can't stop particular actors for particular reasons for saying, I don't want to participate in that system. I don't want to be part of that. But I think overall, it's turned out to be so useful for the internet and for human activities to have something like the DNS that it's going to continue to evolve in ways that people need it to.
So it's so entrenched in everything and all the applications that we use that it's going to be really hard to large scale
dismantle. I think it's entrenched even more than that, though. I think it's entrenched in a good way. I think it's entrenched because it's such a useful facility that people aren't going to be willing to give it up. They're going to fix it instead. They're going to keep fixing it and expanding it instead. I think Leslie's right that one of the things that could change is how the process of finding out what a name means. You know, just because no technology stands still. You know, but DNS is pretty long in the tooth for an infrastructure technology. So is IP routing. So, you know, and this is where
but Leslie. But not IPv6.
This is where Leslie can talk about
IPv6. But, yes.
But I won't. Not today. I
think people will not give up the good things lightly. And I think there's a positive impact there.
Yeah, and I think you really did hit the nail on the head in terms of one of the most important features of the DNS, namely the consistency of naming something in particular, right? I mean, a lot of the use cases that we see for alternative naming systems are all about how do you find the stuff that you want, which is largely what happens when you don't quite have the name, but you may have a part of the name, or you may have a concept of what you're looking for, as opposed to in, no, it's this set of letters right here, and I want the IP address, which is something that DNS does rather well. It's what it was designed to do, and I take Suzanne's point that that's something that people are going to want to keep having done well for them for a while to come.
Well, not to go back into IPv6, but I'm just going to bring up IoT, Internet of Things, and all these devices, right? I mean, just between us, how many of us are actually wearing something that is an IoT device or have within our, you know, yes, I know.
Tracy watches.
At least 10 devices between the three of us, right, that are in very close vicinity. So how is this going to impact, right? Because all these devices have to be found, have to have some sort of a nomenclature, have to have some sort of a address. And we've already seen that there's a lot of, do you remember the baby monitor, the Mirai botnet coming from the baby monitors that were installed and, you know, not really good security implemented and, you know, turned into a huge incident. So how is that going to change the landscape?
Well, I think what happened with the Mirai botnet is actually a pretty good example of a couple of things. One is that, yeah, there were all these devices that, you know, typically if you're setting up a device in somebody's home or in a particular constrained space or for particular use, you don't want it to be on the internet where it can be reachable from anywhere. You probably, you know, and people don't think about it that way. So what happens is they say, well, we'll just do this, just like with any, you know, with a laptop or you know, a device in your on your enterprise network, a laptop or a printer. It's no big deal. It's okay if this is addressable all over the world. Well, no, it's not. And what had happened in that particular case was all these devices that could be addressable from, you know, could be found from the internet, even though there was no reason for them to be. That was just the easy way to do it. Were used in a denial of service attack against a very large DNS provider. That was so huge, and the speculation I heard about it was that it was actually accidental. The people that launched that attack did not know what they were doing. But that was so catastrophic that it actually drew a lot of attention to how badly IoT operating systems were being done, mm-hmm. and how important DNS was. Mm-hmm. I think actually a lot of people have learned from that, and unfortunately we're going to have to continue to learn from our mistakes around things like that. But wow. One of the things, to go back to one of the foundational questions really quickly, one of the things that has changed in 20 years is there is an enormous, much, much, much more awareness. Even though it looks like we're being outpaced by our mistakes, there's much more awareness, not only among technology people, but among, you know, people who aren't technologists, people in government, people in other aspects of industry that are very aware of these kinds of risks and are actually very committed to dealing with them and preventing future mistakes or dealing with future challenges. And I think that's actually something we're much better at than we were before. It's just that the challenges got bigger too. Mm-hmm.
So this sounds like an ongoing challenge, and I'm sure that we could keep talking about security and infrastructure for many hours to come, but we should probably wrap up for now, give our listeners a bit of a break, let them chime in, say they want to hear more about this at a later date. So at this point, I will say thank you very much to Suzanne for joining us today. And see you.
Thank you very much for having me. This has been terrific. Looking
forward to seeing
your reaction.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod, and you can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this podcast or ideas for future episodes. Be sure to catch all the episodes in this privacy and security arc, including conversations with Mark Rotenberg, Suzanne Wolf, and Eve Naylor. You can follow TechSequences on Twitter to hear about new episodes and topic arcs. Thanks for listening.